right, we have one case remaining on our 10:30 docket. The clerk will please announce counsel. All right, Mr. Anderson.
May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Jeff Anderson. I represent Kevin Clark, who's sitting over here. In a partnership dispute between Mr. Clark and his former firm, Cotton & Schmidt. Just briefly, I'd like to summarize how we got to this point. As all of you know, Mr. Clark started practicing here in Fort Worth in 1982, or came to Fort Worth after he practiced in Houston for a few years and was with the Camp Jones firm, then had his own firm with different partners. And in 2001, he joined what was then Kirkley, Schmidt, and Cotton that became Cotton & Schmidt, the defendant in this lawsuit. He became an equity partner in 2003 under the partnership agreement that is the subject of this lawsuit. Shortly thereafter, Lyndall Kirkley, who we all know, left, and there were negotiations between Mr. Clark and Mr. Kirkley on behalf of Cotton Schmidt. The sum total of this lawsuit, I believe, deals with the statutory construction of the partnership agreement of Cotton and Schmidt, and then whether or not Mr. Clark is equitably estopped from asserting the position that he asserts in this case. And essentially, if the court will turn to Chapter 12 or Article 12 of the partnership agreement, which is attached as Appendix 1 to our brief and is in the record, a withdrawing partner like Mr. Clark is entitled to certain payments under the partnership agreement. There are three different payments that the defendants point out. One is the payment of partner compensation addendum, which is certain amounts of fees that have been collected or will be collected over the next 24 months. And then B, his percentage of contingency fee interest that are collected within a certain time. The part of the partnership agreement that this case concerns is not 1203A or 1203B, but 1203C. And at the trial court, Mr. Clark moved for summary judgment based on the fact that this is clear, unambiguous, and should be interpreted to entitle him to much more than the $4,642 that he was given upon his departure. And the wording of 12.03C is important. It's not talking about payment under the partnership compensation addendum, which is the way that the 11 partners at the time were compensated. And it's not talking about payment under the partnership compensation addendum for contingency fees. It's talking about the repayment of the capital investment that the partner makes. And it's undisputed in this case that when Mr. Clark became an equity partner in Cotton Schmidt, he paid in a capital investment. And if the court will read with me, the 12.03C says, the partner, upon departure, is entitled to repayment of his or her capital investment in the partnership calculated as an equal interest in the depreciated book value of all partnership assets, less an equal proportion of the partnership long-term and capital debt. And if it's in the negative, then it offsets sections 1203A and 1203B. All partnership assets are defined by the agreement. This is the agreement that Mr. Clark signed on and agreed to, but it was drafted by the partnership long before his participation as an equity partner, 5 years before. Partnership assets are defined as cash balances, physical assets, notes and accounts receivable, and the work in process and contingency fee. Now, this is not payment under the partnership addendum, but this is in repayment of the capital investment. Now, those numbers have been calculated in our brief, and they're in the record, as calculated by the documents produced by Cotton Schmidt. The cash balance was $4,542.35. Physical assets were $124,622.46. The notes and the accounts receivable were in excess of $2 million, $2,136,436. And the work in process and contingency fee interest were $2,456,283. And according to Section 12.03C of the partnership agreement, Mr. Clark, in repayment of his capital investment, would be entitled to 1/11th of that amount. One-eleventh of that amount is $429,148. Now, what's significant is the posture at which this dispute sits at this point. Clark moved for summary judgment, partial summary judgment, that the contract was clear and unambiguous, and that he was entitled to these numbers as calculated. Cotton Schmidt did not dispute or move for summary judgment saying that this is not what the contract said. They simply said that Mr. Clark is not entitled to enforce the contract as it is written because he is equitably estopped. So as this court looks at the record and reviews the denial of the motion for summary judgment under a de novo standard, this court must apply the rules of construction, which necessitate that clearly Mr. Clark is entitled to his 1/11th of this amount of money.
Are you saying that the only basis for their summary judgment motion was the theory of equitable estoppel, as opposed to a fact issue as to the value of the capital account?
They did raise a fact issue as to the value of the capital account, and they also disputed the terms of the contract in response to our motion for partial summary judgment. And in their brief, they've well set out that they don't construe the contract as we construe the contract because of other portions that are really boilerplate that say things like the purpose of this contract is to operate an ongoing business, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't move for summary judgment that said as a matter of law, this contract means something different than Mr. Clark says it means. Their response to our motion for summary judgment was that it did not mean that.
Was the original payment of the capital investment calculated in the same manner as the repayment?
No, it was not. The original payment was, I'm not exactly sure how it was calculated, but it was a $25,000 payment that Mr. Clark made when he became an equity partner in January of 2003.
Okay.
So if this court, looking at the court's denial of the motion for summary judgment based on the contract construction, this court must reverse that denial. It's entitled to look at the record de novo and look at the clear language of the contract that was written and must be construed against Cotton Schmidt, and Mr. Clark would be entitled to his 1/11th of that number. Now, Your Honor, you've been asking the parties this morning, what do they want? What we want with regard to this first part is a reversal and render that Mr. Clark is entitled to this amount. I realize that there may be a fact issue on the amount that Cotton Schmidt raised, and it's pointing out that some of the matters should not have been taken into account with regard to the accounting that was prepared by its accountants. I'm not sure that argument is correct, but this court could reverse and render on the breach of contract and on the contract construction and render for a trial on the damages to determine what the 1/11th of Mr. Clark's partnership interest is. But I'll turn now to the equitable estoppel argument. And I think it's key in order to determine whether or not equitable estoppel or quasi-estoppel applies in this case to look at the situation that the parties were in at the time the letters were written by Mr. Conrad, signed by Mr. Clark, and sent to Mr. Kirkley. And this case is distinguishable from the cases upon which the defendants rely, but first, I want to go through the factual scenario. Mr. Kirkley leaves the firm a very few months after Mr. Clark has become an equity partner. Clark wasn't with Mr. Kirkley, Mr. Broyles, Mr. Cotton, Mr. Schmidt, Mr. Conrad, and the rest of them when they left Brown Herman in 1992. He has no idea what the intent of the agreement was when they executed it in 1998, but he's recently become a partner in this firm. And according to the affidavit that's on file, he is told, sign these letters because our negotiations with Lindell have become too acrimonious. We don't want to talk to him anymore. You talk to him for us. So in doing that, Mr. Conrad wrote the letters providing what, and this is key, what Cotton Schmidt said it believed was the correct interpretation of the contract. As Mr. Clark signs these letters and sends them to Lindell, he is not taking that same position on behalf of Cotton Schmidt. He's simply doing what he is told at the time. Now, indeed, he is a partner, and I can see your eyebrows moving, Justice McCoy, and you want to know why it is that he shouldn't be bound by that. He's been practicing law for quite some time, and he is a partner in the firm. And the reason he should not be bound from an estoppel standpoint is this. At the situation that Cotton Schmidt and Mr. Kirkley had in 2003, they're in the process of negotiating a split. No lawsuit's been filed. No documents have been filed in the deed records. People are simply taking positions. And if Mr. Clark is to be bound by this position, equally so would a partner of Cotton Schmidt be bound by a position if they wrote a letter, let's say if Ms. Baird wrote a letter to Mr. Cotton and said, Larry, I don't understand what Section 15 means. I don't think it's clear. And later there was some separation of Ms. Baird from the partnership, but she wanted to take the position that that same section to which she referred to in her letter was abundantly clear and in order to her benefit. By her simply writing that letter, she would be quasi or equitably stopped from asserting that position if she got into a dispute with Cotton Schmidt. That's not the way the cases on which the defendants rely work. Generally speaking, I think the Cimarron property case is key. Cimarron property involves a couple taking a piece of property subject to deed restrictions that prevent them from operating a business in the subdivision. They write a letter to Cimarron Property and say, may we operate this daycare? Here are the parameters under which we're going to operate the daycare. Cimarron Property then says, yes, well, we don't think that the deed restrictions prevent that. Now, clearly, they probably did. But Cimarron Property took that position and recorded it in the record of the operation of that that development, and it made it took a stance that it's entitled to take, altering the deed records as they are altering the HOA agreement as it relates to these folks over here. And then Cimarron Property turned around and after a jury trial lost and asked to prevail at the Court of Appeals, saying we're not quasi-estopped. The court found that they were quasi-estopped, or held that the jury's findings were correct on whether or not the deed restriction kept the Keens from operating their house because of the actions that they had taken in the past. Unlike the Keen case, this is more like the Barker versus Roll case, where a lawyer has written a letter expressing an opinion to someone and then comes around later in an actual proceeding filing documents to the contrary. Here, what we have in this case is simply negotiation between a law firm and a departing partner. And if we look at the record in this case, the intent of what Mr. Clark did at that time, the way the conversations or the way the correspondence was crafted, and the motive behind the negotiations with Mr. Kirkley are all fact issues for a jury to determine in determining what Mr. Clark's intent was. And to determine what exactly was going on at that time to give rise to the court applying the doctrine of quasi-estoppel.
And I think in your briefing you mentioned that he was appointed through some committee process at the firm to handle the negotiations. Is that correct?
Well, you've hit on a subject of another, more dispute. Cotton Schmidt characterizes it as a committee set up to handle the negotiations. Mr. Clark in his affidavit says negotiations had been broken down between people who had been partners for many years, and they asked me to sign the letters because they did not want to communicate with him anymore. So whether or not there was a committee established is another issue that is out there. But simply, these three letters written by Mr. Clark cannot give rise to a matter of law estoppel for his right to seek his entitlement under the contract that Cotton Schmidt drafted. For these reasons, we ask this court to reverse and render verdict in Mr. Clark's favor, or reverse and remand for the fact issues that remain in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Sims.
May it please the court. Counsel, this case is about an equity partner in a law firm who, for his own financial advantage, and for the advantage of the law firm, opposed a withdrawing partner's interpretation of the partnership agreement in 2003, then 2 years later, withdrew from the firm and adopted the same interpretation he had previously opposed. This raises the following issues. One, which of appellants' conflicting positions regarding the interpretation of the partnership agreement is correct? And two, is appellant barred from asserting the interpretation he advances in this case when he previously asserted a contrary position and benefited from it? With respect to the first issue, the interpretation appellant advanced in 2003 and the interpretation that the Cotton Schmidt firm has consistently advanced throughout the years is the correct interpretation. Sections 1203, A, B, and C of the partnership agreement address payments that are to be made to a withdrawing partner. 1203A entitles a withdrawing partner to payment of a percentage of fees that are collected on hourly rate cases following the date of withdrawal. 1203B entitles a withdrawing partner to payment of a percentage of fees that are collected on contingent fee and bonus fee cases following the date of withdrawal. These two provisions, 1203A and B, provide a mechanism for the withdrawing partner to receive payments for accounts receivable, work in process, and contingent fee interest matters when the firm is actually paid for them.
But don't A and B apply only to the withdrawing partner's contractual right to receive a portion of his own accounts receivables and work in progress?
Following the date of removal or the date of withdrawal, they do, for up to a two-year period, which, again, I think one of the important things about this is contracts have to be interpreted from a utilitarian standpoint in the context of, in this case, the practice of law. Most lawyers will have collected within a two-year period all the fees that they would be entitled to from accounts receivable, work in process, contingent fee matters within a two-year period. But I will say under Section B, there's not even a time limitation on it. The contingent fee interest could be collected for any period of time out there, and the lawyer would still get his percentage that he's entitled to there. So those two sections do, in fact, provide the mechanism for the lawyer to receive the work in process, contingent fee payments, and accounts receivable when the firm actually receives them. On the other hand, 1203C entitles a withdrawing partner to a payment that is calculated based on the depreciated book value of the partnership assets minus or less the long-term capitalized debt. And this is significant because when 1203A, B, and C are read together and in context, it's clear that accounts receivable, work in process, and contingent fee interest are not to be included in the 1203C calculation. It's also consistent with Section 501 of the partnership agreement that requires the accounting of the partnership for all transactions to be based on the cash basis of accounting.
Well, it seems to me that A and B, as pointed out by Judge Livingston, could apply to an associate. It's how much am I bringing in my work, my capital gain, contingency fee cases, my hourly cases, I get a part of them when you collect them. Whereas when we get to C, this doesn't talk about an associate, this talks about a partner. I own part of an ongoing business, and so when I leave the ongoing business, I'm entitled to a portion of the worth of the ongoing business that I purchased when I made my capital contribution.
Except that, Your Honor, in section, I believe it's section 302 or 303 of the agreement, it specifically provides that the business is not to be calculated and looked at as an ongoing business. When a partner withdraws, it is not, the work in process and those kinds of things are not viewed as an ongoing business. And so that's also consistent with the interpretation that's advanced by Cotton Schmidt in this case. And I think it's important to...
What is it if it's not an ongoing business?
Well, the payments to be made to the withdrawing partner are the withdrawing partner receives those payments that it is that he or she are entitled to, that they would have received had they been there.
Talking about A and B?
Right. That's
A
and B.
A and B is a problem at all.
Okay,
right.
And then those are, I think it's important to recognize that those are the accounts receivable because they haven't been collected at that date.
Right, just like an associate. Okay.
Yeah, but there are different provisions in the partnership agreement that apply to associates and other types of partners.
I know, but I'm following you. But okay. What about C?
1203C is what's called a capital investment repayment. Capital is key. There are capital assets and there are non-capital assets. Work in process, accounts receivable, those are not capital assets. They have no depreciated book value. And under 1203C, the term depreciated book value limits and defines the assets that are to go into the calculation under 1203C. And by definition, then, work in process, accounts receivable, contingent fee interest are not included in the 1203 definition or that calculation.
Okay.
When we look at the way 1203 A, B, and C fit together, it would also create a windfall if the 1203 A and B payments were included in the calculation of the 1203 C capital payment, which is what the appellant advocates in this case. For example, appellant has received 26 payments following his withdrawal as a partner under 1203 A or B, yet he also advocates that those same payments should be included in the calculation under 1203 C. Additionally, a significant portion of the accounts receivable that appellant wants to include in the 1203C calculation were over 4 years old at the date of his withdrawal, and some were over 10 years old as of the date of his withdrawal. And anyone who's practiced law for any period of time knows that these accounts receivable and work in process are carried on the books for many years without there being any real way or any relationship to reality that they will ever be collected. Additionally, the position that the accounts receivable work in process and contingent fee interest should be included in the calculation of the 1203C capital payment leads to absurd results. Indeed, appellant's interpretation, which would lead to a double recovery, is absurd, unreasonable, and oppressive. Again, for example, appellant became an equity partner in the firm in 2003, and he paid $25,000 to become an equity partner. Under his
was that a capital investment?
That is a capital payment.
So
it would be carried on the books as a capital payment.
So probably the phrase repayment is probably not the best choice of words here.
I would agree with that. It's certainly under the way the agreement is put together, it certainly does not mean that you get back exactly what you paid in. And I think, again, from a practical standpoint, when you become a partner in the firm, you're receiving profits the way this agreement was set up. You're receiving profits that you don't earn, that you don't have anything to do with. You're receiving firm profits as an equity partner while you're a partner. And so he would have received those as he was a partner. He receives the monies that he's entitled to under the work in progress and that sort of thing. And then he receives this capital payment that's calculated based on how the agreement defines it. But it has to be a depreciated book value calculation, which, again, by definition, excludes these non-capital assets like work in process and accounts receivable.
So the good news is you're now a partner. The bad news is you're now a partner.
Well, again, you know, I think that the purpose of this partnership agreement, like most law firms, is to create a situation where partners are encouraged to be there to practice law and to contribute their talents and skills to the law firm. And in this case, the argument advanced by appellant is sort of the antithesis of that. And that is, if you look at the examples, if he paid $25,000 in 2003 under his argument, he could have withdrawn within 2 weeks of that payment and claims to be entitled to be paid $170,000 under Section 1203C. If you look at his argument today, he paid $25,000 in 2003, withdrew less than 2 years later from the date of that payment, and now claims to be entitled to be paid $430,000. That kind of interpretation is...
under C?
Under C.
Okay.
That kind of interpretation simply yields absurd results and is antithetical, you know, to the purpose for which the partnership was created. To the contrary, that interpretation, if accurate, would promote the withdrawal of partners because of the windfall that they would receive under the partnership agreement.
Let me ask a question, though. I think what I'm curious about, though, is let's assume for purposes of this discussion that basically the law firm gets 50% of every dollar collected, and the working person, whether it's an attorney that's a senior partner or an equity partner or not, gets the other 50%. What happens to and how is the withdrawing partner compensated upon withdrawal for the 50% that gets left in the firm?
It becomes a function of the fact that the firm, the way it's set up, the firm gets a percentage for overhead and that sort of thing. All the other percentages are paid out in fees and, you know, draws to the partners and that sort of thing. So the amounts that are retained by the firm for overhead solely go to the overhead of the law firm for its ongoing operations, which enable the firm to collect the monies that are in accounts receivable and work in process that get paid to that lawyer over time. You know, this is a situation where the law firm is trying to continue doing business as a law firm, but at the same time it has a partner who's withdrawn, and it's going to pay that lawyer over time for the fees that it would be entitled to, or he or she would be entitled to. And at the same time, under 1203C, they get back whatever the capital payment is called for under 1203C. So it is a situation that allows the law firm to move forward and at the same time gets the lawyer paid back at least part of that capital investment that they originally paid, which is a preeminently fair and reasonable way to deal with this. The second issue to be determined by the court is quasi-estoppel, not equitable estoppel. And that is significant because equitable estoppel requires some sort of detrimental reliance. Quasi-estoppel simply precludes a party from asserting to another's disadvantage a right inconsistent with a position previously taken by the party. And in this case, appellant is in effect arguing that he signed the letters to Mr. Kirkley in 2003 with his fingers crossed behind his back, that he misled his partners as to his true beliefs and intentions regarding those letters, and that he breached his fiduciary duties to Cotton Schmidt and the other equity partners, just so that he could advocate a different position and interpretation and claim more money later on when he decided to withdraw at some point in the future. That is clearly inequitable or conduct that would be barred by quasi-estoppel. I see my time is up. Appellee would request that the court affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Sims. Mr. Anderson, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honors, may it please the court, I will be brief. In the questions that we've just asked of Mr. Sims, the court has hit on the crux of this case. If this court affirms the trial court's judgment, it has effectively rewritten the Koch-Schmidt Partnership Agreement. And if we look at Section 12.03C, it talks about the capital investment in and what is to be evaluated in the repayment of that evaluation, and it is not capital assets. It is all partnership assets. All partnership assets are defined by Section 3.02 of the agreement that include the work in process and the accounts receivable. So if the judgment is affirmed, essentially this court would have allowed the trial court to rewrite this agreement because, as Mr. Sims pointed out, well, it's oppressive and we didn't mean it that way and we wish we hadn't have done it that way. But that's exactly what it says, and it should be enforced as it was written. There may be a fact issue if there is an impaired AR or an impaired WIP that would be depreciated book value of the assets that are there that the court may determine. But the actual wording of the agreement must stand as it is written. Turning to the doctrine of quasi-estoppel, let's take, for instance, if Mr. Clark had sat in a committee with four lawyers who were trying to determine what position they were taking with Mr. Kirkley. And Mr. Clark said in that committee, I don't believe the agreement means what you say it means. And they said, well, our partnership agreement allows us to take a vote. We're taking a vote. We vote this way. You vote against us. Now you have to write the letter because you're speaking for the partnership. He would then be quasi-estopped from ever challenging the agreement, even though he did not believe it to begin with. Simply put, in this case, we have three letters that go on in a negotiation. There is no detrimental reliance by anybody. There has been no official position taken by anyone. And if there is anything, there is a fact question as to whether or not Mr. Clark is quasi-stopped from asserting the rights that he has in this case. But more than that, the three letters do not, as a matter of law, entitle Koch-Schmidt to this equitable remedy.
Are you saying Koch-Schmidt has taken a position, but Kevin Clark hasn't?
I'm saying that was the position of Koch-Schmidt. And because Kevin Clark signed the letter, Kevin Clark is a partner, it is the position in the negotiation with Mr. Kirkley of the firm at that time. Whether or not he is bound by the position of the firm, whether or not he is bound by simply writing the letter, are issues that really should be determined at the trial court. But in this case, clearly, he's entitled to assert his rights under the contract, and these three letters do not give rise to the level of unconscionable conduct, which is what is required. And during Mr. Sims' argument, we didn't hear that word spoken once. All we have here is negotiations and a prior partnership dissolution. As a result, this court should reverse and render in favor of Mr. Clark, or reverse and remand in favor for a trial on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Sims. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is submitted. That concludes our court for this morning. If the clerk will please adjourn us.